I'm Predica Chasso, and I want to talk about strings at perimeter. Well, it's very hard to start a talk about strings without telling you what string theory is. So here it is. It's a theory that contains closed strings, open strings. It also contains fibrils. In the form of T0, we can also have particles. So it's not just a theory of strings. The standard picture of what a string theory is nowadays is summarized in this picture, where you have M theory. Use this. Where you have M theory in the center, and then the five string theories in 10 dimensions and 11 dimensional supergravity as a low energy effective theory of M theory. But I would like, probably many people have talked about the meaning of M, and I would like to give another meaning for M. I would like to say there is a mathematical framework, in fact, a consistent mathematical framework, to discuss quantum gravity and gauge theory. And as such, it's a very big framework, and many people here do many different things, and we have very little overlap with each other. So that shows the breadth of what this framework is about, okay? So let me start introducing people working in this research area, okay? Here is the faculty. So we have Pedro Vieira, Jaume Gomis, Alex Buschel, myself, and Rob Myers. Of course, this picture looks a little bit weird because we're missing something. But in 2012, we're going to complete it with Davide Gagliotto, who's coming, and that's going to be a great addition to our research area. Of course, I shouldn't forget to mention our postdoctoral researchers. So in the past 3 years, we've been very lucky to have very good postdocs. So some of them have gone already into faculty positions and onto other postdocs positions. And we also have Sam Vasquez, who went into finance. Now, last but not least, I should also mention that we have a very active group of 12 graduate students working right now at Perimeter. Very good. But how about research? So that was the old picture that I showed you. This is a more modern picture, at least a snapshot of what we do at Perimeter. So we have ranges from describing new states of matter through integrability, early cosmology, supersymmetric gauge theories, scattering amplitudes, applications to condensed matter physics. Okay? So it's going to be very hard to give you an overview of everything. So we have selected topics that we can discuss in different length. So I'm going to talk about supersymmetric gauge theories, quark gluon plasma, a little bit more at length about scattering amplitudes, and then Pedro will talk about integrability. So supersymmetric gauge theories. Well, we know very well that in 2 dimensions, if you have the Ising model, it exhibits something very strange, which is a strong weak coupling duality. Okay? In 4 dimensions, we also have dualities, the electromagnetic duality of electromagnetism is something very tantalizing. And you would run, the holy grail would be to understand an interactive non-abelian, the NA stands for non-abelian, quantum field theory in 4 dimensions. So how do we do that? Well, there is N=4 supergermions, which some of you might be familiar with. If you're not, that's called the, some people call it the harmonic oscillator of quantum field theories. So that theory has a strong weak coupling duality in 4 dimensions. But there are other theories that we also expect to be able to understand their strong coupling behavior. But they are very complicated. And getting inspiration from here, you would think that you can make progress if you understand the magnetic degrees of freedom, which would be the important degrees of freedom and strong coupling. Well, that sounds like an impossible thing. But in the past 3 years, there's been a spectacular progress in understanding dualities, precisely by taming magnetic degrees of freedom. And Jaume Gomis has been leading that research effort here at PI. Now, at the Rigg collider, or the relativistic heavy ion collider, you collide gold atoms, and you create a new state of matter. Now, anything that you know how to do very well nowadays, all the techniques that we know, will not work for this new state of matter. And it seems to require new tools. The new tools come from string theory in the form of holographic techniques. And people using the holographic techniques were able to compute an interesting ratio, the ratio of the shear viscosity to the entropy density, and found that it had to be greater than 1 over 4 pi. Or in fact, they found that precisely N=4 supergermials has 1 over 4 pi, at least in the approximation they were using. So could this be a lower bound of nature? Well, why would I say that, or why would people say that? Well, if you plot different values for different materials, helium, nitrogen, water, you see that the bound is very, very low here. So it seems to be a reasonable conjecture to say that this is a lower bound of nature.
it turns out that the quark gluon plasma, at the temperatures where you can see it, is almost close to that bound. Okay? So still, we don't know anything that violates that bound. So you could ask, is it truly a bound of nature? Well, it turns out that probably not, because Rob, Alex, and Aninda were able to give a rigorous proof that this viscosity bound is, in fact, violated in quantum field theory. So if nature realizes different quantum field theories, or at least we think that this is a correct framework to describe nature, there is a chance that this is not an absolute bound, and there might be situations where it's violated. Okay. So as I said, I'm going to discuss a little bit in more detail my own research area, which is on scattering amplitudes, at least in the past 3 years. But in order to do that, let me give you an introduction a little bit of why we do that. So quantum field theories, as we know very well, are the backbone of our understanding of nature. Well, the special class of quantum field theories are gauge theories. And as we all know, and it's written on the blackboard somewhere there, quantum electrodynamics is one of the most spectacular theories in terms of predictions. Of course, nowadays we say that the most successful theories, perhaps, are the electroweak theory and quantum chromodynamics, QCD, put together into something we call the standard model, which is extremely successful, and we know we're working very hard at the LHC. Well, I'm not working very hard, but somebody's working very hard to find ways the standard model actually fails, but it seems to be very, very solid. And of course, we have gravity, which at the classical level is described by a quantum field theory, too. So what are the pillars of our best quantum field theories? Well, I would say that they are locality and unitarity. Okay? So we have to work very hard, or we've been working very hard, to produce frameworks or ways of describing nature so that we make manifest locality and unitarity. So I want you to remember these two pillars here. So our main window into the particle physics world is given by scattering amplitudes. That's precisely what we do at Tevatron, accelerators, or the LHC. And Feynman taught us how to compute predictions coming from our theory. So he simply says, well, if you want to know the scattering amplitude of two particles coming in and three particles coming out, just sit, use my rules, and compute what it is. So there are the rules. Nobody discusses that the rules are correct, so you just sit down and compute them. Okay? Well, so we could think, or we could just take the approach that Lucien was discussing yesterday, of just shut up and calculate. Okay? So that would be one approach. However, there is something that tells us that that's not quite correct. Or there is something perhaps beyond that. So even though the rules are simple, already simple processes are give extremely long answers. You would say, so what? If this is nature. So if you're computing a scattering amplitudes of gluons actually happening at the LHC, you might expect that the answers are just complicated. So, of course, there is nothing, as I said, there is nothing wrong with that if that were the intrinsic nature of the object. Okay? However, in the 80s, it was found that some miraculous cancellations happen. So tons and tons of pages collapse into a single term. So whenever that happens, that's usually the first hint that a better way must exist of thinking about a problem. And if one is very lucky, perhaps reformulating non-theories in different ways can serve as a springboard for new physics. But precisely, Lucien told us yesterday that if we are reformulating something, perhaps we have the right to say that we're doing foundations of quantum field theory. Yeah, he agrees. Excellent. Very good. Okay. So what are the hints that there is a new formulation? Well, in 2004, in collaboration with Brito and Fenn, I proposed a set of new recursion relations which produce all these compact answers in a very simple way. Okay? In 2005, together with Witten, we found a simple constructive proof of this procedure. Now, the natural question is, if these new formulas don't come from a Lagrangian, which is the starting point always in all quantum field theory books, you start with a Lagrangian and then you discuss Feynman rules, then could they come from a new formulation of the theory? So here I gave you a schematic picture of what happens when you scatter two particles and you produce four particles. So two gluons coming in, four gluons coming out. The BCFW recursion relations, as they are called, will give you the answer in terms of three terms, which I've schematically drawn here. While if you do Feynman Diagnosis, you will have hundreds and hundreds of terms. So all these hundreds of terms can be resummed and written in a very compact form. Now, you would say, well, if I want to find a new formulation, what do I do? Where do I start? Okay? So I want to propose a slight modification of Lucien's approach to quantum foundation, which is the following. You shut up, calculate, and then contemplate. Okay? So you sit here, you look at this, and you stare for it maybe for a year. In fact, in this case, it was maybe more than a year. And then all of a sudden, the true picture or the true meaning of the equations start to emerge. And that's really what it is. At first, of course, you would say, well, there is nothing beautiful about the three terms that I had. But the more you stare at them, you start to understand that there is something deeper in the pictures. Okay? Well, I tell you, these BCFW terms are really three different animals. Yeah. So finally, you understand what the pictures are trying to tell you. They are trying to tell you, here the key observation is that the more compact expressions you get for here, the less local they look. So locality was actually at the heart of making expressions complicated. So once you liberate yourself from locality, somehow everything starts to collapse into smaller and smaller objects. And the more compact, the less local they look. And I think this is clearly the case. Very good. So armed with that, you know that you have to start looking for something strange, some new way of doing physics in such a way that locality is not something that you put in by hand, but something that will emerge. So we found that new formulation in 2009. As you see, it took some years. And the new formulation is the following. So you take your scattering amplitude where you send particles 1 and 2 and you produce n minus 2 particles coming out. And you start, the first step is to encode the data, the kinematic data, which is given usually in terms of n 4 vectors, the moment of the particles. And you represent that in a kind of a strange way. You completely encode the n in a space Cn, so it's the dimensionality of the space we're going to be discussing, and the data of the vectors ends up translated into two planes living in this n-dimensional space. So you have two planes living in this n-dimensional space, and things like momentum conservation that we know is something that we need because of translation invariance translates into the fact that this one plane lives in the orthogonal complement of the other. Okay? So already the dictionary between one space and the other starts to make things that are natural here somewhat strange in the other space. Well, the final formulation involves a K-plane living in this n-dimensional space. So this K-plane, you might say, well, what does a K mean? Well, the K means the following. We know that gluons can carry helicity plus or minus 1, just like photons do. Okay? So when you scatter n gluons, you have to be careful to tell me which gluons have positive and minus helicity. So let's assume that K gluons have negative helicity and n minus K gluons have positive helicity. So the new formulation tells you that the space you should be considering is the space of all K planes in n dimensions, and that's called a Grassmannian. Okay? So as you can see already, the new formulation is encoding the information in very different ways. Now, this K-plane didn't have any physical meaning from the beginning, so we should integrate over all possible K-planes, and that leads to what we call the Grassmannian formula, which is an integration over all possible K-planes with some constraints, and these are just coordinates that mathematicians use. So the details of the formula are not very important at this moment. All I want to say is that this is a contour integral, okay? So the new formulation, what does the new formulation do for us? Well, first of all, the most compact forms of three amplitudes, or three-level amplitudes, are given as residues of this contour integral. Okay? Just compute residues the way you learned in high school, perhaps. And that's what you get. Now, the cancellation of these non-local pieces that we saw, okay? So this contour integral produces the individual building blocks, which were very non-local, very things that we couldn't understand at first. So the cancellation of the non-local pieces became equivalent to a generalization of the well-known residue theorem. So locality emerges as a property of the topology of the Grassmannian. So yet another way, this new formulation encodes information differently. And now, if we apply the same formula and we extend it to n equals 4 superjambians, which, as I said, might be the harmonic oscillator of four-dimensional interactive quantum field theories, then the residues turn out to contain all the information you need to understand the theory to all orders in perturbation theory, not only at tree level. There is some little miracle. Well, I shouldn't say little. It's actually a big miracle that happens. And when you look at them, you start to understand why they look like this. And the reason is that they make manifest a symmetry, which is infinite dimensional. So these objects are actually spectacularly beautiful. So they have lots of symmetry if you know how to look for it. Now, you could say, well, you started with an object that seems to be a new way to think about quantum field theory, but could it be? Can you reformulate quantum field theory in just S-matrix theoretic terms, just describing scattering amplitudes? And you would say, well, clearly not, because how do you describe Wilson loops in gauge theories? So what are Wilson loops? Well, you have a Lie algebra value one form, which is the gauge potential. Then it's natural to produce a gauge invariant operator in this form, where you choose any path in space-time and integrate this object. Okay, and that's called the expectation value of a Wilson loop. How could you expect that these scattering amplitudes will have any information about these objects? If they don't, then the whole idea of reformulating quantum field theory will not be possible. The surprise is that in n equals 4 superjambians, and in 2007, Aldai and Maldacena proposed that, in fact, not only they contain information, they are actually the same thing. They are dual to each other. Okay? So if you have the scattering of m particles, 2 going to m minus 2 of them, okay, what you do is that you take the momenta of all the momentum vectors of all these particles and you put them in sequence one with the other and produce a contour. Now you compute a Wilson loop with this contour, and that happens to reproduce the scattering amplitude. There is a technical note for the experts, which is that this is true in the planar limit and at a strong coupling. That's what Aldai and Maldacena propose.
Sorry?
And light like edges in infinite.
No, actually, they live in the physical four-dimensional space. Of course, Maldacena also told us that if we have a Wilson loop in n equals 4 superjambians, we can think about it as a surface that is extending inside ABS, whose boundary lives on the boundary.
I'm sorry, excuse me.
Yeah, you're jumping ahead because you know that already, so you're just skipping. Okay.
I apologize. Go ahead.
Now, in the past few years, there's been a spectacular progress in understanding this, actually, to any coupling. You might say, maybe that's a miracle of a strong coupling. How about weak coupling, but still at large end? Well, it turns out that the duality has by now been proven, and that's thanks to the work of several groups of people, but in particular, here at PI, Pedro and Amit, together with a group of people at the IAS, have been using integrability very strongly and very successfully to explore this duality and many other things. Also, Dave Skinner, a postdoc, together with people at Oxford, have been using twister theory. In fact, Dave Skinner is our local twister expert, so any questions about twister theory, we know where to go. And also, important progress has been done by Simon Caronhold at the IAS. So let me end by saying that this is not a coincidence somehow. Well, it is a coincidence, but that there are groups of people here at Perimeter and at the IAS, and we decided to start this series of workshops that Rob Myers was explaining to you yesterday. And this is one of the reasons. We've been finding ourselves having lots of overlap, and these workshops have been extremely useful to push our research directions. So now this is a good time to stop and let Pedro continue with the presentation.
Welcome, Pedro. Okay, so thank you. So I will continue then the discussion of some of the topics that we work on at Perimeter in the related precisely to what Freddy was calling foundations of quantum field theory. Here I called it integrability engaged string theories, and I will explain what this title means. Indeed, this is something that we have been doing, so say with Amit Sever, for example, who is a postdoc here at Perimeter, and now he is also at the Institute for Advanced Studies, and he is spending half of his time in each of the places. Also with a few graduate students and some people from the Institute, Davide, which is coming to PI but is now at the Institute, Juan, and also some people from Europe. And so let me start by reminding you that integrability, I added here integrability in 1 plus 1 dimension, but it's more or less redundant, because integrability is something that we are actually used to observing only in 1 plus 1 dimension. So integrability, people from condensed matter know, they know that some materials, if we are lucky enough, they behave effectively like one-dimensional materials, and sometimes we can even perform experiments and do these nice analytic plots, and here are some results from some experiment, and we can even, if we are lucky enough, find materials which are integrable in nature. Typically, as I said, materials which look like effectively like one-dimensional materials. So what is integrability? Integrability, from what I said so far, means that there are models that we can solve exactly. So if we are lucky enough to write a closed expression, here is the energy, here is the correlation function, and so on, this is an integrable model. But more physically, what does it mean? An integrable model is a model where the scattering of particles is very peculiar. So say you take the famous Hubbard model, which is a model that people believe as connections with high TC superconductivity in higher dimensions, but take the Hubbard model in one dimension. So a model where electrons hop, and they have some spin up and down, and they are hopping in a lattice. Then they scatter with each other, you scatter 10 electrons, and you receive 10 electrons in your scattering experiment in the future. In integrable models, the way these 10 electrons scatter in from the past into the future is very special. The only thing you need to know is these two-body interactions. So if you want to know how 10 electrons scatter into 10 electrons, all you have to do is how they scatter in a pairwise way. And the scattering of an n-body S matrix factorizes, this is what this picture means, into a sequence of two-body scattering events. So integrable theories are the next to simplest theories after free theories. So first we have free theories, where there's no scattering at all, the S matrix is one. Then we have integrable theories, where there is an S matrix. The theory can be strongly coupled, the S matrix can be very complicated, but it does factorize into two-body scattering. Why is this a 1 plus 1 dimensional property? Why can't I have this in 3 dimensions or in 4 dimensions? Because what is the underlying symmetry that allows us to have this cute miracle of factorization? So for 3 particles, if you prepare 3 wave packets that are going to scatter at the same point in space-time, now I'm telling you that you can think of this 3 wave packet as a sequence of 3 two-body scattering events. But how could it be? I must have a symmetry which relates this scattering process where they are meeting at the same point to a process where they don't meet at the same point anymore. So there must be some symmetry, and indeed this is what there exist some local charges which actually combine into what Freddy was mentioning, this Yangian symmetry. There's actually, and these extra charges, they have this nice property that you act with them and you translate your particles, just like momenta and energy. But you translate the particles by an amount that depends on their momenta, and therefore wave packets which have different momenta are shifted differently, and therefore they don't scatter anymore at the same point. And therefore, these three guys, if they would scatter at the same point, now we shift them and they scatter at different points. But because they are in the plane, they must scatter sooner or later. However, if we were in 3 dimensions, if we had these extra charges that would allow us to shift the wave packets, then we could simply remove the wave packets from each other and they would never cross each other. And then the S matrix would be 1, and this is the statement that we cannot have too many symmetries, and this is Coleman-Mandula. And indeed, life in 4 dimensions, it's not just a sequence of two-body scattering events, it looks something like this. So it looks messy, it looks scary, and indeed, as Freddy was saying, to do computations, we really need to sum a lot of Feynman diagrams. And here are 2 examples, both from this harmonic oscillator of gauge theories that Freddy was saying, or N equals 4 super young mu, that will be the subject of that will be the theory that I will be focusing on. And here are some diagrams used to compute one of the observables in this quantum field theory, namely the spectrum of the field theory. So you have operators in this field theory. You have to compute two-point functions. And two-point functions are given by some anomalous dimensions. And these are diagrams, for example, used to compute the anomalous dimensions of the simplest operator of this theory at four loops. These are the diagrams used to compute scattering amplitudes, like the one Freddy was mentioning, at two loops. You see there are two loops here for six particles. So you can think that you have two particles coming in, as Freddy was saying, and four gluons being produced. Four particles being produced. So this seems too messy and hard, these four-dimensional gauge theories, but on the other hand, since Tuft, we know that when the number of colors is very large, these theories should organize themselves into a sort of planar expansion. And therefore, in fact, secretly, they should be one plus one-dimensional string theories. They should be one-dimensional theories of surfaces, like one which I triangulated here. Now, you can say this is just a cartoon, and of course this is just a cartoon. So what does it mean in practice? In practice, what we mean is that if we are smart enough, the inspiration of this cartoon is to tell us that if we are smart enough, we should be able, given a four-dimensional quantity in this limit, in this Tuft limit where the number of colors is very large, if we are given a four-dimensional quantity, we should be able to map it into a two-dimensional computation, into a one plus one-dimensional computation. And then, if we are lucky, and we will be lucky in the so-called simplest conformal field, quantum field theories, or this n equals 4 super young Mills, we can expect that not only we manage to map it into two dimensions, but maybe the 1 plus 1 dimensional description might actually be integrable. But let me first explain you how this works in some simple example in practice. So the simplest quantity in a non-abelian gauge theory are two-point functions. So you have two gauge invariant operators. The simple local gauge invariant operators are product of the fields of the theory, trace of the product of the fields of the theory at a given point in space-time. Right? This is gauge invariant because fields transform by conjugation and there are gauge transformations. So you take the trace of a product of fields. And this is a gauge invariant. Evaluate that a four-dimensional point in space-time, another four-dimensional point in space-time, and you compute the diagrams between the two operators by drawing the Feynman diagrams, studying the propagation of the particles from this point to this point, which can interact with each other and so on. Now, okay, so this would be what we would have to do to compute the simplest objects, two-point functions, in a quantum field theory. So where is the one-dimensional structure? Well, it's very simple in this case. So you have a trace of a product of matrices. You cannot change the order of the matrices. It's a trace of a product of matrices. So here is the one-dimensional structure. It's really at the surface. It is just the trace itself. The trace itself is a one-dimensional structure. I can think of it as a spin chain. I can think of my operator as a closed spin chain. Why not? Who forbids me? Phi is spin up, or in this space spin dot, I called it. Derivative spin ball. And 3, it's this 3 degrees of freedom. It's a spin chain state, just from the notation point of view. And then what could these Feynman diagrams indicate? Say Feynman diagrams where this D and this scalar exchanges, and now I have the gluon here and the scalar here. This would be, then, some nearest neighbor spin interactions. The spins would exchange places due to interactions and would start hopping in the spin chain and so on. So let's hand wave a bit less and be a bit more precise. What are we doing when we compute this kind of diagram? We renormalize the operators. We have a quantum field theory, and we are renormalizing them. They mix with each other, and we are computing their divergences and seeing how they mix. So there is a renormalization mixing matrix, or a dilatation operator, which tells us when we renormalize how the operators mix with each other. So it's an operator that acts on operators to give another operator. So it acts on spin chain to give more spin chain. So I can think of this operator as a spin chain Hamiltonian. It acts on spin chain to give spin chain. Furthermore, it's very natural to think of it as a spin chain Hamiltonian because it acts on spin chains, changing with some local interactions. At most, it changes, say, two spins at leading order in perturbation theory. At the next order, it might change a bit further away and so on. Okay, then what do I do with this operator if I have this Hamiltonian? I should do two things. I should compute the spectrum of this Hamiltonian. I should diagonalize this Hamiltonian. And the eigenvalues, the spectrum, the energy levels of this Hamiltonian are the so-called anomalous dimensions of the operators, which tell me how two-point functions behave, which give me the spectrum of the theory and tell me if I compute two-point functions of this four-dimensional theory, how they decay with the distance.
And I should compute the eigenvectors of this Hamiltonian, the quantum states, and these give me what are the states which have definite anomalous dimensions. Okay, so this is the first step of all this business, which is to map the problem in four dimensions to a problem in two dimensions. The second step is how to solve this problem in one dimension, in one plus one dimension. And here comes the remarkable feature, as Freddy anticipated a bit, that in the simplest quantum field theories, in N equals 4 super young Milsay, this Hamiltonian is not any Hamiltonian. It turns out to be an integrable spin chain Hamiltonian. And therefore, those integrable models, as I said, they are characterized by the following. You think of this spin chain, say of the derivatives, which were these balls, as particles with momenta p1 and p2 that move in the spin chain. The energy, which was the object, the first object that we should study, the energy of such excitations is the sum of the energy of this guy plus the energy of this guy. So I sum the energies of each of the excitations. Now, pick one excitation, say this red one, and carry it around the chain and impose that the wave function is periodic. Quantized, the moments are quantized, this momenta pi, because the system is a closed system. I mean, it's a trace, so it's a closed system, so the moments are quantized, as in any quantum closed system, compact system. So we pick this, how do we quantize? Well, if the theory were free, I just pick this moment, I carry it around, and I say that e to the I momenta times length equal to 1. But now the theory is integrable. So this guy scatters with this other two, but it scatters in a particular way. First it scatters with the green, then with the pink, and that's it. It scatters just as a sequence of two body scattering elements, k different than j, up to the number of such elements. So you solve these equations to quantize your momenta, you plug them here, and you compute the spectrum of your four-dimensional gauge theory, just using this one-dimensional language. Now, where's the catch? The catch is that these theories also contain something like these molecules of magnetic ions. They also contain spin chains, which can be very small. Now, it's a bit hard for me to tell you that in this picture where you have a spin chain of four sides, that I have two particles that are moving freely and then scattering with each other and so on. It's just too small for this picture to make any sense. So if the picture, if this chain becomes very small, the scattering picture breaks down, and we need a new trick. And the trick, if space is very small, and if you have a huge amount of time in the quantum theory, is to do what condensed matter people call a Matsubara rotation, and what quantum field theory people typically call this Zomolodchikov trick, which is to say that if we have this very small space and a very big time, let's exchange the two. And then we think of the very big time as a very big space, which is great, because then the S-matrix treatment is exact. And we think of the finite space as just some finite temperature, which is not an obstacle. Then we compute this free energy. It turns out that the equations governing this free energy are some integrable equations, very known. They are called the Hirota equation, which are a set of functional equations for functions living in a lattice. These arrows mean neighbors in the lattice. This plus minus mean shift of the argument of the function. With appropriate boundary conditions, this function can be solved in a computer. And here is the spectrum of an operator, the dimension of an operator in a conformal, in a strongly coupled quantum field theory at any value of the coupling. So it's a completely non-BPS quantity. You see, it's this very small molecule which starts with four fields. So the dimension starts at four. And here it is. We plug this equation into a computer. It took 1,000 hours, but now I know that it's possible to do in a couple of hundreds hours. But for us, it took us 1,000 hours. It was actually super cool because we had for people who do numerics, it's kind of embarrassing, but we are a bit amateurs. So what we did was we were computing, and we had each computer computing one point. So it takes roughly 40 hours per point. And then we were iterating the equations, tac, 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 and the points were moving slowly to this curve. And we had all the computers connected to the internet, so they would upload to a given website where the points are. So we would literally see the points moving in the plot and going down to the curve. And we actually had a prediction for how it should asymptote, and it was really beautiful to see. So it was two very fun days that we managed. Okay, but anyway, to solve a four-dimensional gauge theory, we need more. So we need to compute higher point correlation functions, scattering amplitudes, Wilson loops, all these objects, as Freddy was saying. And the message is that we should be able to do it, because this material, this worldsheet material, this two-dimensional surface that arises when we start summing all these Feynman diagrams is the same. Just the topology is changing. Before, I was telling about cylinders. I have a trace operator here, a trace operator here, and they are connected. It's a cylinder, and then it can oscillate, and it can vibrate. It's a string with a topology of a cylinder. Now, for other objects, the topology will be different. The worksheet material is the same. So at Perimeter, we have been trying to tackle this computation of these objects. And the reason is not just, okay, let's compute the next object. No, of course not. So first of all, these objects are more dynamical in a way than the spectrum. The spectrum gives you just a propagation, if you want, of a single string. But these objects start telling you about how strings interact. They are really when the dynamics, the more interesting dynamics start coming about. But one other very interesting motivation for studying more objects is to find really the underlying structure of the theory. So the most fascinating thing for me is to see that different objects, very, very different objects, start showing deep similarities and deep connections in the different structures, and we start seeing that spin chains are appearing in computing scattering amplitudes, and minimal areas appear in several different computations. What I really like to see is these connections between different quantities. So let me be precise again. Three-point functions. Now, instead of one spin chain, we have three spin chains. And what do we do if we want to compute what is the correlation function of three spin chains? Let me remind, so each operator is a spin chain. Now, say, to leading order in perturbation theory, I connect the fields of the spin chain. The scalar goes here, I just connect these lines. I do the weak contractions between the fields of the different spin chains. So what does it mean in this one-dimensional language of spin chains? I have my spin chains here, spin chain, spin chain, spin chain, and I have to break my spin chains. And I have my three spin chains, and I break them into six open spin chains. So what does it mean to break a spin chain? What does it mean to break a quantum system? You have a quantum state of your spin chain, and you separate it into two, so you get two entangled halves. Right? So now you separate, and you have two entangled halves of the spin chain. And now you join this entangled half with this, so you compute overlap of wave functions of these three entangled systems, of these six. So we have this entangled half contracts with this entangled half with this one, and so on. So what do we need to do? Notice that for the two-point functions, what we needed was the energy levels of Hamiltonians. Okay? That might be a tough computation, but okay, it's a set of numbers. It's a spectrum of the theory. Now we need more. Now we need the wave functions. We need to know the profile of these wave functions along the chain because we need to break. So we need to know really these non-local properties of my spin chain. So I really need to know now about the wave functions, so about the eigenvectors. So this is the next step. It's a very fun computation. It's a setup that has not been considered before in integrable models. So also from the integrability point of view, we are developing some new techniques for understanding how to break and glue and take inner products of quantum spin chains. The next object I want to discuss are no polygons and Wilson loops, which, as Freddy said, are related to each other. If you have an amplitude, a scattering amplitude of gluons with momenta k1, k2, k3, and so on, you put the momenta k1 followed by k2 followed by k3, you get a closed polygon. It's closed because you have momenta conservation. So the sum of momenta is zero. You compute the expectation value of the Wilson loop, that is the holonomy of this gauge field along this contour, and you get the scattering amplitude. Now, this was first proposed, as Freddy said, by Aldai and Maldacena by looking at strong coupling and by understanding that the strong coupling computation of the right and the left-hand side are related by a symmetry which people in string theory know as T-duality. Furthermore, how do we compute Wilson loops at strong coupling? The way we do is the following. You draw the Wilson loop at the boundary of this curved space-time that Michael was referring to, so enter the sitter. So we put the polygon at the boundary of Ante de Sitter, which is Minkowski space, and we draw the polygon here in three-dimensional Minkowski space. And then we have to study the following problem. We have to study what is the minimal surface which starts at this polygon and extends into the radial direction of ADS. So it's a purely geometrical problem. It's what's called the plateau problem. Given a boundary, how do you compute the minimal surface? Well, it turns out that we managed to tackle this problem and to solve it for any number of edges here. And it turns out to be given by exactly the same equation that I showed you before, where, okay, the sheets now have a different meaning. The lattice, if you remember the lattice, it was a funny T-shaped lattice. Now it's a rectangular lattice. And the point, again, is that you have these Hirota equations, which start really to show up as the fundamental object in these integrable theories, also in these integrable theories appearing in gauge theories. You solve them in a computer, and you get the amplitude for many kinematical data here headstrong coupling. Okay, so here we are using integrability because we have to compute these minimal surfaces, and we have to use classical integrability. We want to study classical minimal surfaces living in a curved spacetime, and to compute classical minimal surfaces, we use the classical integrability of the theory. So what about quantum Wilson loops? What is the trick to map this problem of computing these quantum Wilson loops at any value of the coupling, how to map it into a 1+1-dimensional problem? This looks more challenging. With the operators, it was straightforward. We had a trace, and we say, okay, the trace is one-dimensional. It's already the one-dimensional structure. We don't need to be extremely smart to get there. Now, here it is. It was a bit trickier. It took us some time. So the idea is the following. Take your Wilson loop and pick two of the edges of the Wilson loop. Choose two of them, and they will play a special role. Now, think of these two edges as a quark and an antiquark, which move at the speed of light. So this is the quark. This is the antiquark. Now, a quark and an antiquark, they source a flux tube between themselves. Okay, and now think in the following way about computing this Wilson loop. You have a bottom part of the loop, which creates some ripples in this flux tube, creates some excitations on this flux tube. They propagate into this white region. They propagate. And then think of the top loop as absorbing these ripples again. Okay, this is fair to do. We can cut indeed what's going on here. This is just the operator state correspondence, if you want. So what are we doing? What did we manage to do? We have excitations created at the bottom, propagate in the flux tube, and absorbed at the top. Now, the key thing is what I didn't read is this 1+1 dimensions. It turns out that this flux tube is one dimensional. So all we need to do is to consider, instead of a 4-dimensional Wilson loop, we consider a 1-dimensional transition amplitude between the future and the past in a 1-dimensional model. And these excitations, these bumps that move in the flux tube and they scatter with each other in the flux tube, they scatter in an integrable way. If you know how to scatter two of them, you know how to scatter three, you know how to scatter four, you know how to study the dynamics of these flux tube bumps at any value of the coupling. And with this, we manage, for example, to predict new all loop predictions, for example, for the behavior of these loops, for some behavior of these loops at any loop order. And so to conclude, to solve a four-dimensional gauge theory, we would need to compute everything, in short. So we need to compute higher point correlation functions, scattering amplitudes, Wilson loop. We are trying to do it. The main tools we are using is this integrability, this two-dimensional approach to the problem. So there are always two steps in this problem. First, so we need to be smart twice. So first, we need to map the problem from four dimensions to two dimensions, right? Say for correlation functions, three-point functions, amplitudes, for any quantity you want to compute. The first step is, how do I map it into two dimensions? And typically, this is very general and not particular to this theory that I've been discussing, which is n equals 4 super young means. The second step is how to solve the two-dimensional model. And in this called simplest quantum field theories or harmonic oscillator of field theories, like n equals 4 super young means, you can use integrability, which is a technique that people have already developed a lot in condensed matter to try to attack this problem. So basically, this is what we have been doing. The main goal at the end of the day is to find not only a unified language and to understand the deep connections that start to appear between these different quantities, and also in practice to have plots. I mean, what we want is we have this Konishi operator. It starts at 4, it goes so on, and this is a plot, any value of the lambda. And as physicists, this is one of the things that we want. We want to be able, this is a scattering amplitude at 8 gluons. Let's plot it, and let's say what should the experiment, what should an experimenter measure. Okay, and now we should go into questions. So I prepared a couple of keywords to inspire you and to remind you of this, more or less describe the, give you a rough idea of what I work on, and hopefully it can inspire questions. Okay, thank you. Yes.
I mean, if you try to use these techniques on gauge theories like QCD, which can find.
Yes.
Can you still map them to some spin chain?
Yeah, the map to spin chain is just a question of you have a trace, and there is as much information in writing a trace as writing a spin chain state.
Okay.
Do you have anomalous dimensions in theory which are not conformal? Yes, but they don't govern the full behavior of the two-point function. They govern the ultraviolet behavior of the two-point function.
Okay.
So you would still have, do you still have a dilatation operator in N-conformal theories? Yes, but they don't govern the full two-point functions. They give you the ultraviolet behavior. It would be very interesting to understand the role of the exponential decay in this language.
But can we then do numerics on these one-dimensional spin chains? I mean, using
yes, in principle, yes. Yeah, in principle, yes.
Also, the equation wouldn't be integral.
For example, in GCD at one loop, if you consider particular particular operators made of trace of, I forgot exactly which ones are. I think if you consider f plus minus and fij, where they are in different planes, and if you consider a chain of such objects, at one loop they are still integrable. But then at higher loops it breaks down, so it is not integrable anymore, but you could still solve it in a computer, yeah. Actually, in practice, for example, the quantity that we are studying, this when you have these wave functions and you start breaking and overlapping these wave functions and so on, I'm not completely sure that this is already something very complicated. Even to solve with integrability, we have been using some heavy computational methods just to write these wave functions and to be able to decompose them. Like, even there, maybe it might be interesting also to explore numerics, just to study it, because it's, yeah, in general, some variational methods and so on, yeah. I should discuss with different.
But you need not just the ground state, but you need the full spectrum of that.
Yeah, there's a big difference with what people do in condensed matter, typically here. So we do borrow some techniques, but we tend to ask a bit more than what condensed matter people ask. So we ask, first of all, not for the large L limit. We don't want the thermodynamic limit only. We want any possible length. We also do not want the ground state. We want all possible states. So
that's the catch.
Having the spectrum and the three-point function.
Yes.
That's sufficient if you do
OP. Yes, yes. It is sufficient. Yeah, that's the main motivation for studying three-point functions, of course, yeah. So in principle, but of course it's very much in principle, because in practice, I mean, yes, to say that here is the solution of the theory. Here are the two-point functions, here are the three-point functions, now glue them together. This is true. You can indeed, you have three-point function, conformal block, you sum over all everything that can flow, and this gives indeed the solution of the theory. Now, in practice, it will be very hard to just sum over everything and so on, because they are complicated. Or maybe not. Maybe when you try to put them together and write these sums, say, for example, each energy that flows is the energy of this quantum spin chain, right? So to compute each energy individually is impossible, because they solve some very complicated quantization conditions, and if you have spin chain of length 20 and the 11th excited state, you cannot get a number for it. I mean, just put in a computer. On the other hand, we know that these correlation functions, these four-point functions, at three loops and at two loops and even at one loop, they are nice closed expressions. So this is something that I've been starting to explore with Jean-Paul Adams. It means that, which is also a postdoc here, it means that somehow the questions that you ask the spin chain, you don't ask for individual energy. You ask for particular sums over energy. And those sums are the simple objects. So there are some quantities in spin chains which are not just energyless states, but particular sums of energies that help to simplify dramatically. And this will be interesting also from the spin chain point of view to understand what are these quantities. This is some, yeah. Yes?
So in principle, there's an algorithm in the planar case for computing n-quant functions.
Yeah, at living order, for example, if you want to compute four-point functions, you have four chains, you cut into eight open chains, and then you glue. This is the living order. Then you would have to put...
Right. So is it true that the complexity of doing that computation on a classical computer is exponential in n?
It's more than exponential. It's more than exponential.
It's like factorial?
Yeah, it's actually more than factorial, so... Because it would be, I think it's, so let me see, you cut, it should be factorial square for three-point functions, factorial cube for four-point functions, probably.
It's like Feynman diagrams.
It's the same complexity as Feynman diagrams.
Yes, it's the same complexity as Feynman diagrams, yeah. If you do it without integrability, yeah, so what you get treat, so if you have spin chains of length L, L1, L2, L3, L4, the complexity goes like L1 factorial, L2 factorial, and so on. But the integrability gets rid of the L. L becomes just a parameter. Now the complexity will increase, typically if you put many excitations on the spin chains. But the length of the spin chain, all these combinatorics associated to the length are taken care of by integrability. And then the complexity due to the number of magnons, it's quite nice, because if you have just 1, 2, 3, 4, sorry, I used the word magnons, I should have used the word excited, these impurities on these spin chains, these fields which are not scalar, So the complexity of them, so if you have a few of them, it's simple. But if you have many, it's also simple because you can take classical limits of these expressions. And it's quite neat also to take this classical limit of this correlation function, then it starts describing this merging and gluing of strings. And it's quite neat then to study the interplay with strong coupling and weak coupling, which is also something that we are doing. Yeah. So effectively what we describe when we compute three-point functions of three very big spin chains is like a splitting process, a very quantum splitting process of a very large string, for example. Which is
I'd like to ask you about the thing that I was confused about in Freddy's talk.
Yes.
Are you discussing totally arbitrary Wilson loops here or only special ones?
We are describing null polygon Wilson loops. So polygons whose edges are null. So they live in three-dimensional space and the edges are null.
So in principle there's more off-shell information that's not accessible by this.
Yeah, so there's a very obvious problem that we started we thought it was so trivial, actually, that when we published this Wilson loop, we said we put a reference say, to appear. We thought it would be to be solved in 1 week or two, but it's taking us more than 1 year, which is to do the following. There's a nice generalization. You pick the null edges, and now pick very small null edges. And with very small null edges, you can approximate any smooth curve.
Yes.
So in principle, by studying this continuum limit of this problem, you should be able to approximate any curve in the background. And this is something that I've been working with John Polito. I don't know if he's here. And Amit and Juan, and it's really much harder than it sounds. But it should be possible to do. So we are now starting to... Now I think that we have at least some window because we became a bit less ambitious and we are studying now the circle and excitations around the circle, and there we have more control, and I think everything is coming together, so I'm more optimistic. It's a very interesting problem. It's a beautiful problem and much harder than it sounds.
Okay, and one more of these questions.
Yes.
So let's say you think about, for example, a six-point.
Yes.
So for six-point functions in this approach, it's a very complicated calculation.
Yes.
You have this
yes.
Wilson loop with six edges. You decompose it in various ways. We discussed the...
So six-point, you mean six-point scattering output, like this.
That's right.
This hexagon, yeah.
That's right. But on the other hand, you go to the weak coupling limit,
yes.
And you look in Freddy's talk.
Yes.
And there's some coefficient functions that multiply polylogarithms.
Yes. No, actually, this picture that I was describing here, for example, it's extremely efficient for computing the hexagon. This is a loop. This is a quantum picture. It's not a weak coupling. It's not a strong coupling. It's at any coupling.
Yes.
And we used it. Here are predictions for L loops. And in particular, at one and two loops, they completely fix the answer. So, and they allow to fix the answer to compute this hexagon Wilson loop, say, for example, that you are mentioning, without doing a single Feynman diagram up to two loops.
Oh, so you get some, for example, a differential equation whose solution is the polylogarithm.
What we get is the following. We pick these two lines. We could have picked two different other lines. Mm-hmm. So whenever we pick two lines, we get the discontinuity in one particular, what we call, channel.
Ah.
And then we say that this discontinuity is some log of some cross-switch. Mm-hmm. So then, what is the function whose discontinuity is this log of this cross-section? It's the polylogs that you are speaking about. Now in another channel. And you impose, you bootstrap the other answer, and then you come up with all these polylogs and so on.
Okay.
Yes?
Can I ask a question about the bound on the shear viscosity to the entropy density?
Yeah, that's for Rob, actually.
Maybe, yeah, sorry.
We have the expert.
Yeah. So you have particular quantum field theories which violate the bound, or you just can prove that there are quantum field theories?
No, well, that's how you prove that the bound isn't satisfied. We provided a bunch of counterexamples. Well, there's a bunch of counterexamples that violate the bound.
And are they sort of pathological in some ways, or are they?
No, the point is they're not.
They're not.
No. The thing that distinguishes them, if you like, from what typically we do in a holographic setup, which is where this story comes from, is that you're including fundamental matter, mm-hmm. whereas the story we just heard about was all adjoint matter, uh-huh. matrices.
I see.
So that's one way to think of the distinguishing feature.
I see. Okay, that's pretty simple. I mean,
yeah.
Essentially.
Yeah. But then the larger part of the story was trying to frame the calculation in a situation where everything was under control, mm-hmm. and you could really believe the answer for mm-hmm. A and for S.
Good. Other questions from anyone?
David, you're helpful.
Okay, let's move on to particle physics.